Blog Talk Radio.
Welcome to Ringside Wrap, a production brought to you by GeorgiaWrestlingHistory.com, where we bring you the latest news and information on major pro wrestling and MMA promotions, the occasional history lesson, and interviews with legends of yesterday and stars of today. And now, the GWH Radio Network presents Ringside Wrap.
Good evening, everyone, and welcome to Ringside Wrap. Les Thatcher and Mike Sempervivi here with you. Rich Tate hiding out in the studio. It's 8 o'clock on the East Coast, Wednesday, February 8th. And Les Thatcher is on the line right now, and I have to ask Les if he's going to be able to write off his appearance this week on Wrestling Observer with Brian Alvarez off on his taxes for the charity work he did not blowing up at him.
I don't know what I could write it off as. Are you a tax advisor or what? I don't know.
I just killed it. Brian is 1 year older than me, but it drives me nuts when he watches Mid-Atlantic stuff that I had a chance to watch when I was little. And he's just like, what about that Paul Jones? I don't know. It just drives me nuts.
you know what? How are you? I'm good. How about you, Mike?
Not bad.
Good. You know what I think is when I hear him and Vinny talking about is he's excited about it because it's actually wrestling.
Yes.
And it makes sense. So that's but that says something too, doesn't it? I mean, you guys aren't like old beat up guys, you have no agenda, it's not like, well, back in our day, you know, and of course the guy, you know, myself and the guys from my era are accused of that. And yet when guys young enough to be my grandchildren are turned off by the current product, you think, well, maybe we've got a point. I don't know.
Last Saturday, I live in, you know, Fenwick Island, Delaware, which is really right on the Maryland-Delaware border. So to drive down to Virginia doesn't take all that long. And last weekend was really nice weather over here. It was almost 60 degrees. It was sunny. It was just a freakish winter day. So just went on a drive, and we drove south and into Chincoteague, Virginia. And you go by, you know, it's just, you know, all they did there was they got seafood and oysters, and they did tobacco and things like that. And driving through, and it's a labor-intensive old town, seaport town that you go through, and it just, you know, I'm thinking Royal Rumble's the next day, and I'm thinking this is a Saturday night where we're going to and driving back, and I'm looking at the clock, and it says 6 o'clock, and I'm just thinking about all of these people, quote-unquote, back in the day, waiting for 6:05 the same way a lot of us did, and it's just, you know, I'm thinking, you know, this stuff could still work today. The people haven't changed. The psychology hasn't changed. None of it's changed. And it was like, you know, as soon as I get home, I'm going to just put on old, you know, Georgia Championship Wrestling and old Mid-Atlantic stuff and watch that. Now, what I ended up doing was coming home and watching WWF stuff from the 70s for God knows what reason why. I don't know what changed my mind, but it was just like I'm thinking on that ride, Nothing's changed. Nothing's really changed with the people. Styles have. There's things that have been updated, but the basic things always work. And, you know, hearing Vinny talk on today's Brian and Vinny show about, I've been a big proponent of, you know, you should have a squash match on every show to showcase somebody. And just some of the things they were talking about, I was thinking the same thing of just like, yeah, you know, we're the ones now that are saying back in the day, and it's just, it's just mind-numbing. It really is. You know, you brought up, I think, I'm sorry to keep rambling here, I think you brought up a great point about the Elimination Chamber, and now they're going to have, you know, they've been able to manipulate it into a TV show. Guess who's going to get the last spot in the Elimination Chamber? And like you said, it just took away a great deal of the drama of watching, you know, a gimmick match in the Elimination Chamber. And it's just nobody else has said that, but it's like one of those things that the average person doesn't think about or the average fan doesn't think about online because they're wrapped up into what they personally like, and they don't realize the effect that that has.
Yeah, they any good movie doesn't give you the punch, the finish in the middle of the movie, or you hear me, Ava, about Justified or Sons of Anarchy. It's because they leave you wanting something. They give you a reason to come back. They don't just give you everything on the front end and they expect you to get excited about it. But that, you know, it's like any of these matches, they keep giving it to you on television for free. My question is, some of these matches aren't that special to begin with, and then they expect you to pay $50 for it after you've seen it two or three times for free anyway. And some of these people that are in these matches, I mean, it's not their fault, it's nobody's fault, it's just they're not of the skill level of some of the, you know, of guys like, say, you know, okay, how many times can you watch Steamboat and Flair against one another? I mean, even they have a saturation point, or Briscoe versus Funk, or, you know, or any of the great feuds from the 70s or, you know, 60s, 70s, or even the early 80s. But those guys, I mean, here again, they were practicing their craft against a multitude of different other levels and types of talents. And practicing is 6-7 nights a week. So, you know, even if you were just an average performer, you were still, in terms of, you know, being able to do whatever it was you did, able to do it more efficiently, better, smoother, because you did it more often. And it's just, it's mind-numbing to me that someone doesn't understand this and try to, to do something about it. I don't know. It's kind of crazy. And of course, you know, I was asked today about, am I upset by the lack of depth of talent and that the fact that I said, sure, you know, the art of professional wrestling is dying. And no one's doing anything to resurrect it or to maintain it because they just try to cover their tracks with bad comedy or mediocre storylines and, you know, bad acting. And it really doesn't work. I mean, they will still draw some semblance of audience. I mean, there were a lot of imitations of the Three Stooges, which was really classic comedy. But they're still not out there, and they're not, you know, nobody's, you know, resurrecting any shrines of them. There's always going to be somebody to watch, but the art itself is fading. Well, you know, and here's the other thing too, with the chamber deal, Mike, I said last week, it's a soft show to start with. Then you give them two chambers and really no particular reason for that. You had Big Show and Daniel Bryan once again, and like I said, to Brian Alvarez, I said maybe they'll come up with a Midgets versus the Giants pay-per-view theme, you know, where you have to be under 5'5" and over 6'9" to be opposed to one another. I mean, that whole David and Goliath thing has been done to the point where who cares, you know? And if you don't care, if there is no speculation as to how can this little guy handle that big guy, well, then you've done it to the point where nobody cares anyway.
I'm not a little guy. I should have mentioned this earlier. As we mentioned last week, Nigel McGuinness is going to be on joining us at 8:30. Of course, you're going to have him respond to Jimmy Rave's comments last week about him with the potato, but hey. Les, did you get a chance to see William Regal's comments this week that I guess were on Twitter.
No, unless somebody posts somebody's Twitter comments somewhere, I don't trend.
I figured you did not, but I wasn't sure if this was put up anywhere else. But I guess he just, you know, he did this on like a separate blog page because he has a lot to say in response to somebody about, you know, what it takes to become a wrestling superstar. And I'll just go over a little bit of stuff for you. He said, you know, one of the big things is learn the basics properly, you know, find a school with a good rep, and a trainer who's got a great pedigree. Learn the basics properly, get and stay in good condition. And he mentions that there's a big difference from looking in condition, actually being in condition. Saying he's a believer in Hindu squats, Hindu push-ups, and most importantly, proper bridging, nose on mat, feet flat on mat. Work hard and have respect for the job. Good manners go a long way. Treat people the way you would like to be treated. Enjoy it. And he goes on after that, but, you know, as far as the Hindu squats, and I got to ask you, when it comes to bridging, obviously guys who were football players, we all had to roll back on our helmets, amateur wrestlers, you get to learn this, but kind of a question of an extension of things I've asked you as far as, you know, the non-pro wrestler or the non-athlete who grew up loving pro wrestling and wants to be involved in it. The neck is it's a lot stronger than you think it is, but a lot of people have neck phobias I've come across, you know, over time where they just, you know, that bridge is daunting to do on the top of your head, let alone going all the way over to your nose. How do you teach that? Is there a way outside of just neck strengthening?
Yeah, just doing bridges or you know, you can even, like, with a head harness with, you know, which has a chain and you hook a weight to it. Most weight rooms don't have those things anymore. They're not necessarily antiquated, but most gyms, modern gyms, are afraid of lawsuits, you know, because you could, you know,
they won't even have punching bags in some because they're afraid people will break wrists.
Yeah, exactly. So, but yeah, doing what they call wrestlers' bridges, go up into a bridge and rock back and forth, rock left to right, right to left. You know, if you're lifting relatively heavy, your neck tends to strengthen anyway, because you're not necessarily consciously, you know, tensing the muscles in your neck. But if you're bench pressing, when I say relatively heavy, it doesn't have to be 500 pounds for one rep or anything, you know, quite that dramatic. But if you're doing heavy benches and forcing, you know, the last couple reps, to get the max out of it, then your neck's, you know, getting some tension on it anyway. So, you know, that was always something. Or pulling necks, you know, just we used to do, I only call it bull in the ring if you want, is circle guys. Nigel's been through this drill before too. Put one guy in the middle, and he locks collar and elbow, and those guys start pulling. You know, until you say break, and then he's going clockwise. He steps to the guy to his right, and again to his right, and again until he's made that in a complete circle. And there, I mean, you talk about that. Now, a lot of times your shoulders, forearms, and your neck are blowing up by the time you make the complete rotation. It's, but you know, that's, there's so much in so many pseudo trainers and training centers that they actually don't know what they're teaching, or they don't teach basics. You know, you hear all these horror stories about, well, this guy did a moonsault my first day in camp. What? I mean, you don't know how to take a bump. You don't know how to lock up. You don't understand any of the basics, and you did a moonsault. So many of these schools, you know, it's not an education, but they find ways to entertain you, basically, to have you continue spending your money. And I can tell you, when Harley and Steamboat and I were doing the camps around the country, you have guys come in telling you, well, my trainer, this or that. I had a kid tell us, we were up in New England, but a number of years ago, and he came to me during the break and said, you know, a couple of friends of mine in Boston wanted to come to the camp this weekend, and they couldn't make it. And I said, oh, that's too bad. I said, they couldn't afford it or just couldn't get off work. Oh, no, their trainer said that you old guys couldn't teach them anything.
Now, unreal.
Yeah, never mind me, but you think Ricky Steamboat could teach somebody something, or Harley Race might be able to be wise enough to show you a little something. But that trainer, whoever that was.
You could even say you guys wrote the book on it.
Yeah, and this trainer, whoever he was, wasn't a good trainer. And he was smart enough to know that if this kid, that whoever they were talking about, spent two or three complete days in the ring with us, they would go back to Boston knowing that he didn't know a damn thing. And that would ruin the whole illusion. You know, that's one of the things, Mike, that I always tell promoters. I said, you know, listen, if your trainer's young, then I guarantee you he doesn't know it all. He can't possibly know it all. If he's never worked at a high level, then there's things he can't possibly know anyway. So it's as important for him to come to the camps that we do as it is for any, because hopefully when we go away, your trainer is a better trainer. Your athletes more understanding what a professional wrestler is. And
you do with DJ Hyde, correct?
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, well, that was, you know, that was one of the things that scored points with me with DJ when we first conversed. I mean, we had never met before. I had no idea who he was. And he called and he said, I hear good things about what you do. He said, and I not only want my students to be good wrestlers, I want to be a better trainer. Bob Evans has done the same thing, you know, and Bob is no young squirt either. But, you know, that's the thing. I haven't quit learning. As a trainer, you know, a personal trainer in the gym where I work or in any of these gyms, I mean, you know, I still try to find better ways to do what I do. And when it's no different. You know, you've heard the story. Well, once you stop learning as a wrestler, then, you know, you become, then you obviously are, you know, a detriment to yourself. It's just, there's so many things. You know, something that now, that Lance Storm and I emailed back and forth about, and we were on before this aired last week, is the impact from England, where the Haskins kid crashed and burned, and Aries kicked him and then gave him a cradle pile driver. And I thought, what the? I won't use the strong line, but I'm thinking this is so irresponsible, so dangerous. I mean, and that's, you know, and I've heard people say, well, the kid did this or the kid. First of all, if you saw the kid he was a spot monkey. They ran a little clip of him before his match with Aries. And he did the exact same moves, move for move, in the clip that he did with Aries. Lance had pointed out that the kid missed so many, you know, if you don't ever hit a move, then it makes no sense. It doesn't register with people when you miss it. Meaning that if I'm throwing, I throw a drop kick at everybody I wrestle and I miss every drop kick, there's no real impact. Now, if I throw in two drop kicks and hit you with two, you sidestep the third one, and I go down and sell like I've landed on the back of my head. Now, we've established something. We've told a story. But anyway, the kid, you know, did the Northern Lights or whatever the hell, you know, the big moonsault thing. And it appeared to me that Aries was rolling out of his way. And so somebody said, well, the kid, you know, almost hit. Well, here's the deal. The kid's in the air. And if you're supposed to move, whether you're Austin Aries or Mike Sempervivi or Les Thatcher or Jesus Christ, then it's up to you to get the hell out of the way. Because once the kid is in the air, he has no control. But this kid came down, and Christ, I thought maybe he broke his neck. So what do you do in that situation? A professional, and may I emphasize, a professional in that situation, immediately covers him, tells the referee to count three, and gets that kid the hell out of that ring. To find out if he's broken his neck, if he has a concussion or whatever. Now, if he is at fault for some reason, then you chew his ass out when you get him back there and find out he's alive or he's healthy, you know. But you don't go ahead and stomp on him and then give him a move that's putting him right back in jeopardy of, if that neck has been injured or his spine, of doing it, of worsening the situation. That is totally, totally unprofessional. And it was, you know, after seeing that in the low key thing, I thought, Christ, you know. And Lance said, you know, it's that attitude. We've got to get our shit in.
Yeah, and that's the worst. I know we got to go to a little short break here, and then we'll be right back and get back into this too. Especially coming off the heels of the low key thing, that was, I mean, I'm not, you know, see roundly, but it was roundly panned, and it was made clear that this is dumb. This is not how you do things, and everyone pretty much said that. You and Lance both included in several different forums, and for them to do this, and then again being on tape delay to me too. You and you have time to edit stuff like that out. It should have been edited out just off the principle of it, but heaven forbid TNA would do something like that. But going to a short break here, and then we'll be right back.
Georgia wrestling fans, you're going to want to make your plans to be at Johnny G's the first, third, and fifth Sunday of every month, 2 p.m. bell time, for Rampage Pro Wrestling television taping. And fans, if you're in Middle Georgia, make sure that you watch Rampage Pro Wrestling on Fox 24, Saturday 9 a.m. on the My 41.2, Saturday at 10 p.m. Cox Communications Cable, Thursday 8, Saturday at noon, and of course, Rampage Rewind, the one-half-hour show on Cox Communications throughout the schedule. Fans, be there.
Do you remember Tommy Rich? What about Ray Gunkel or Gordon Soley? Can't get those nasty Anderson brothers out of your head? Well, you can catch them again at GeorgiaWrestlingHistory.com. Who was on the first card you attended? Who was it under that mask? Remember the first Omni Spectacular or the big main events at the Bell Auditorium? What happened in Columbus on my birthday? Find out at GeorgiaWrestlingHistory.com. Whether you want to get back some of your past or maybe you just want to find pro wrestling in your area, check out GeorgiaWrestlingHistory.com.
This is Miss Rachel from The Empire, formerly known as Platinum Championship Wrestling. Every Friday night, The Empire presents the best in professional wrestling at the Academy Theater in Avondale State. We're also at the Masquerade every month or so. Check us out on Facebook. Just look for Platinum Championship Wrestling. And you'll get the latest details on all the hottest action from The Empire, formerly known as Platinum Championship Wrestling.
We get it. That's every Friday night at the Academy Theater and at the Masquerade as well every month. We'll see you there.
I was trying not to bust out laughing after hearing the girls talk about Platinum Championship Wrestling, formerly Platinum Championship Wrestling, Empire Championship Wrestling, and seeing them at the Masquerade, and then that music comes on. And Les, what did you think about disco music?
I'm awake, Mike. Yeah. You know what I'm going to say here? I'm going to heal a little bit. Danny Only sent me a link to a match between he and Kyle Matthews, and it was a wrestling match, very good, and asked me to critique, and of course there were ways they could have improved it. I've never seen anything that, whether I was part of it or somebody else was part of it, that couldn't be done better. But what drives me crazy and is so low rent Bush League is guys on the indie level. It's like open mic night, and they're doing commentary live in an arena. That is so distracting. That is so bad. Please, if you're listening to this, please stop. I mean, when I realized where it was taped, because I'd seen Kyle against Davey Richards from there, I pushed a little button and turned the volume down. As a professional wrestler, that would drive me nuts.
I'd like to add an addendum there too. I'd like to add that in for any mixed martial arts show or for any boxing show. We're both also bad at that, especially when they're at bars or a nightclub.
Yeah, it's. I don't know what they think they're accomplishing, except they're pretending to be a play-by-play commentator, and they can't get any. I mean, they can't get their stuff on the air someplace, so they're going to do it in the auditorium, But the biggest problem with that, too, is, you know, and I've heard it this way, and I've seen it this way, and it's just, well, Rich Tate is sneaking up on Mike Sempervisi. Okay, well, the three or four people or the 100 people in the auditorium hear it. Do you think Mike Sempervisi might have heard it, too? And why the hell didn't he turn around? You know, it's just, like I say, it's low rent. It's Bush League. It's distracting. And well, when I call it Indy, that's not a compliment.
Well, but in about 5 minutes, we're about to lead into to Nigel, who obviously, you know, is doing commentary for ROH right now. So, you know, it's just like the actual in-ring work of wrestling. It's like a lot of things with wrestling. Commentary, everybody thinks they can do it. And, you know, we see Jim Ross on the sidelines, and you see what's going on with WWE. But, you know, TNA's pretty much had the soul sucked out of him. Nigel's great. Kevin Kelly's great. But it's, you know, again, it's like any of these guys doing it or guys who do, you know, local shows and things like that. It's just not everyone can be an announcer. You're not Jim Ross. Find your own voice. You know, it's one thing to mimic, you know, to say Walking Condominium or something like that, you know, in reference to Gorilla Monsoon or something, like slipping in something is one thing, but, you know, it's just like wrestling. You have to find your own character and your own voice being an announcer, or you just come off as an overforced goofball.
Yeah, Jeff McCallis, who trained under me and is a young trainer in Denver, who I would recommend to anybody. I mean, Jeff, which is maybe not a compliment to a lot of people, but is a younger extension of myself. But, I mean, he's flown all over the country to work camps with Harley and Steamboat and myself and Dr. Tom and everything else. I mean, he's a student of the game. The first time I went to Denver to do a camp at his place, they had a show. Well, not the first, the second time, whatever. He had an investor who wanted to do its open mic night, and Jeff knew my stance on that, and he said, I've told him not to do it, or you're liable to come take the microphone and put it where he wouldn't think it would fit. And I said, well, worst thing, I can leave the auditorium since it's his money. But, yeah, it's, like I say, it's distracting. Years and years ago, we were working a spot show somewhere. It was out of the Nashville office. And this guy, I mean, I forget where it was. It was sponsored by, say, an American Legion or somebody, and one of their people was the, you know, the ring announcer and so forth. And I don't remember the heel I was working with, but this guy, during the match, got on the microphone, was making some, you know, he thought he was Johnny Carson or somebody, and making some, you know, remarks which he thought were funny. And I told the heel, I said, throw me out by that guy. And I went out, and I came up, and I kind of grabbed him like I was trying to get my balance. I come up, I said, listen, asshole, if I hear one more smart comment out of you on that microphone, I'm going to come back out here and whip your ass. And I meant it. I mean, it was an insult to us in the ring. And you know, announcers are not the entertainers. And although I realize in this day and age so many think that they are, they're not. You're not part of the entertainment. You're just and live in the auditorium is just horrible. You heard Terry Taylor when he was on with us a few weeks ago comment that he had, you know, that he had contacted me when he'd first done Color with Gordon or whoever it was on WCW and said, man, I've come to respect what you do far more than I ever did before by trying to do it. It's not an easy job when it's done right, you know, but that's, there again, Mike, that's the sadness of the industry as overall, you know, especially at the independent level. They're inadequate wrestlers, inadequate referees, inadequate announcers, inadequate promoters. I mean, that's not to say everybody is, but sadly enough, there's more of them than there are of us. And there's no way of putting a stop to that, you know.
It's unfortunate that a guy who is a slightly more than adequate wrestler is only a slightly more than adequate, and no, I take it back. Nigel McGuinness, who is more than adequate in everything that he does, is going to be on here after this break, so we'll be right back on Ringside Wrap.
Hey, how you doing? This is Joe Walsh. I'm speaking on behalf of Rad. It's okay to rock and roll, right? But don't drive home drunk. But if you're drunk, call me up. I have a limo. I'll come and get you.
I'll sleep all day. service announcement brought to you by the U.S. Department of Transportation, RAD, the National Association of Broadcasters, and the Ad Council.
The odds of a young girl being discovered by an industry insider while singing to herself pumping gas? 1 in 300 million. The odds of the daughter of a clergyman from Severn, Maryland spending 11 weeks at number one on the U.S. singles charts? 1 in 19 million. The odds of going on to win 6 Grammy Awards? 1 in 1.4 million. The odds of selling over 40 million records? 1 in 800,000. The odds of this musician and performer having a child diagnosed with autism? 1 in 110. I'm Toni Braxton, and I encourage you to learn the signs of autism at autismspeaks.org. Early diagnosis can make a lifetime of difference. Autism Speaks. It's time to listen. Brought to you by Autism Speaks and the Ad Council.
Do you remember Tommy Rich? What about Ray Gunkel or Gordon Solie? Can't get those nasty Anderson brothers out of your head? Well, you can catch them again at GeorgiaWrestlingHistory.com. Who was on the first card you attended? Who was it under that mask? Remember the first Omni Spectacular or the big main events at the Bell Auditorium? That happened in Columbus on my birthday. Find out at GeorgiaWrestlingHistory.com. Whether you want to get back some of your past or maybe you just want to find pro wrestling in your area, check out GeorgiaWrestlingHistory.com.
What's up? We're Boys to Men.
How do we educate our kids so they have a fighting chance in today's world? We don't have to tell you that children face pretty tough challenges these days.
We adults need to go the extra mile to make sure our kids find something in school that really sparks their interest, like music. Teenagers who study music and arts tend to find tough science and math concepts easier to grasp.
It has to do with development of something called spatial IQ. And music and creativity go together, too. We know from our own lives that teachers who appreciate creative thinking embrace our love of music.
So, help prepare your children for life. Encourage them to learn to love music.
A PSA brought to you by MENC, the National Association for Music Education, Gibson Guitar, Baldwin Piano, and this station. March is Music in Our Schools Month. Music, part of a sound education.
Georgia wrestling fans, you're going to want to make your plans to be at Johnny G's the first, third, and fifth Sunday of every month, 2 p.m. bell time, for Rampage Pro Wrestling television taping. And fans, if you're in Middle Georgia, make sure that you watch Rampage Pro Wrestling on Fox 24, Saturday 9 a.m. on the My 41.2, Saturday at 10 p.m. Cox Communications Cable, Thursday 8, Saturday at noon, and of course, Rampage Rewind, the one-half-hour show on Cox Communications throughout the schedule. Fans, be there.
Welcome to today's lottery drawing. And today's winning numbers are not yours, not yours, and another number that's not yours. And the final number is not yours.
When it comes to having money, don't rely on luck. Brew your own coffee at home instead of buying that latte. Brown bag it to work instead of ordering in. Go to feedthepig.org for more free ideas on how to save.
Feedthepig.org.
This message brought to you by the American Institute of Certified Public Accountants and the Ad Council.
All right, we're back here on Ringside Wrap. Les Thatcher here with Mike Sempervivi, and I'd like to invite on our guests at this time, former Ring of Honor World Heavyweight Champion and current Ring of Honor announcer extraordinaire, Mr. Nigel McGuinness. Nigel, how are you tonight?
Very well, thank you, mate. Top of the morning to you.
Yeah,
announcer extraordinaire.
All those many years ago, when you were starting out with Les Thatcher and
many
beating up on you, did you ever think when you wanted to become a pro wrestler that you would one day be able to call on all of Les Thatcher's skills and learn some commentary?
I certainly didn't see my career ending up that way, no, but I'm very glad that it did, actually, and I don't end up to be a dribbling vegetable.
Nigel, I got two questions to ask you, two things. First of all, when are you going to dump the sunglasses so everyone can see those eyes that mesmerized so many young ladies in the greater Cincinnati area years ago?
Yeah.
Two, Jimmy Rave last week said you were stiff. I said, hell, I didn't teach him to be stiff. Is that true? Did you stiff Jimmy Rave?
Oh, tremendously stiff. I was awful, rotten. It wasn't my fault, you know. Like, I just, you learn, don't you? You sort of learn by the people you wrestle. And, you know, I had a baptism of fire somewhat wrestling some of the guys higher up in the card. And I don't think it's stiff. I mean, it depends on your notion of what pro wrestling should be, I suppose. You know, were you to grow up and go through the dojos in pro wrestling Noah in Japan, then it's not stiff, it's just realistic. But then were you to learn, I don't know, back in the southeast, you know, back in the walk and talking days, then maybe it would be stiff, you know. But that was the style I kind of learned, as how I evolved. That's, you know, I went from that British style, which was very light, you know, you could barely even feel people, Johnny Saint, those sort of guys. And you just sort of developed from there. So I feel terrible for Jimmy, I really did. He broke his jaw, actually. It's a funny story. He broke his jaw, and I always got the heat for it, because and that's why they called my finish the Jawbreaker Lariat, because after I hit him with it, he had to take some time off for a broken jaw. But the two weren't related, believe it or not. We just tried to get the old Lariat over with he'd broken his jaw earlier, but it wasn't my fault. But I did hit him hard. I hit a lot of people hard, because people hit me hard first of all, and you know, that's the way you learn. You go with what works, right?
Yeah. Likely story.
What do you mean, yeah?
You know what? Seriously, watching the television, I know you're becoming more comfortable in your role of doing color with Kelly. So I'm happy for you there, because you're contributing more and more. Like you and I had talked, you know, a while back at lunch, you're adding in more of your wrestling, you know, like this is what I would do or what I would have done or what he should have done to get where he wants to go. And I think that's making it a lot more interesting, too.
Good, because, you know, and that's after I talked to you, and Kevin had the same sort of notion as well, you know, they say great minds think alike, but that was when we did the second and the third set of tapings, that was the kind of direction that he said we needed to move in, and we tried to give me more opportunity to work on that angle, on that side of calling the match. So I'm definitely more comfortable. I'm still not 100%. It's weird. I was talking to somebody the other day, and with wrestling, and certainly not to put myself over by a long shot, but once I did my retirement tour and I was going out there, and I sort of felt like, man, I'm not actually bad at this. You know, I've learned a lot. I mean, I've learned a lot about just psychology and where things work and how to do all the things that you learn over the years. It's not until you stop and look back and you go, God, dang, I could, you know, write a lot about that. You could write a decent book about, you know, how difficult it is to have a great pro wrestling match. But when it comes to commentary, I don't know. I mean, there is so much to learn, but I don't know when you learn it. You know what I mean? I guess on car trips, stuff like that, talking with people maybe the same way as you do actually being a wrestler. But I guess because there's so many more styles in commentary, you just got to find what works for your voice and your sort of, you know, your sort of pacing, I suppose. I don't know. I'm still learning, but loving it along the way. Really am.
Yeah, I think a lot of it is you just, when you see something unfolding in the ring, then you enhance it by turning it into a mini story or something. But it's not through my eyes or somebody else's, through your eyes. So it's going to be a little different than, even if you're trying to, you know, I think Jim Ross and myself and probably a couple other guys would tell you that Gordon Solie was a yardstick for us or someone that we look to.
Yeah.
you know, as a role model, but yet we didn't do the same thing, but yet looked at,
right.
you know, basically tried to look at it as he looked at it. And I think that's, you're right, it comes with time, and it's not something, you can't sit down, I don't think there's a class that you can take to do it. It's just something that you evolve in,
yeah.
or you, you know, as you go.
Well, you don't, right, exactly. I know that, like, I try to watch some of Joe Rogan, and the way that when he's commentating on UFC stuff, he adds a, you know, a different color to what, you know, the other guy's saying. So I think that's more of the notion we're trying to go for sure.
Yeah, that's good, too. Yeah, I think he is good. Yeah. I like him and on his stuff, too. Yeah, that's a good idea.
Nigel, there's been so many great ones, Jim Ross, Gordon Solie, Ken Walton, depending on where you were. I mean, they were great announcers. Who sticks out in your mind as far as, you know, guys who are just, you know, they just, you know, for me, you know, growing up in the Mid-Atlantic area, even though I love Gordon Solie, Bob Cottle, Lance Russell, Jim Ross, for some reason those guys mean more to me than anything. Who are some for you that were just like, when you think wrestling, they are the voices of wrestling?
Obviously, Heenan and Monsoon were the guys that I grew up watching, you know, and I remember it wasn't until I actually got into the wrestling business that I really got it with Heenan. And when I went back home, I was still training, maybe had a first match or something like that, but I went back home and I watched the Royal Rumble, 92, the one that Flair won, and at the time, it was a fantastic, arguably one of the best rumbles of all time, you know, and at the time, all I knew was it was a fantastic match, but when I went back and I watched it, and I listened to Bobby Heenan, and how he told that story as it developed, even though he obviously knew exactly what was going to happen, that to me was magic. I was like, man, and he just so subtle with it as well, and he had such a great ability to make jokes, but make jokes at the right moment, but still, you know, the important parts he'd sell seriously, you know. So certainly Heenan, I think, was someone that always stands out in my mind.
Did you ever have a chance to, I mean, Les, did you, when you show tapes of old matches, which I would assume you most certainly do, and, you know, you show guys different things, do they ever get a chance to hear you announce your Smoky Mountain stuff or things from Southeast? Do you ever, you know, show guys a tape and they actually start talking about you as an announcer?
Yeah, some guy. Yes, I don't think Nigel ever did. But when I first started training guys, too, Smoky Mountain was on here in Cincinnati. And it was one of the stations here was picking it up off the satellite, along with ECW and the Memphis show, too. But... So they had the opportunity to hear me there, but we.
That
I used
one of the.
Go ahead.
Sorry, I say one of the biggest, not disappointments, but the things I really would have loved was a chance to watch more of your stuff when you were wrestling and commentating, because there weren't that many tapes around as when I was training. I remember they had a good selection of old matches and stuff from various different eras, but there wasn't actually that much of Les commentating or wrestling for whatever reason. And I always felt like I wish I'd have seen that, because on the few occasions where, you know, I saw you get in the ring and just, but I always used to tell people, you can just, and I remember you saying to me as well, that you can tell before someone even steps in the ropes whether they're a good wrestler or not. And that was what I always got, just because just the couple of times I saw you get in and lock up with someone and have them take a headlock, and there was an artistry to it, you know, and that was what really stuck with me. And it just, as I said, a real shame there wasn't more footage around of it, for sure.
Yeah, you know, so much of that stuff was lost. I've still tried. I had probably a half dozen matches when my apartment burned in Knoxville in 82, and I've never been able to replace that stuff. And all the stuff, all the good stuff we did in Knoxville in the 70s, with the exception of a few clips like the Tony Charles and Ronnie Garvin little specials and things that are on YouTube. I don't even know where they came from, but complete shows and stuff are just gone. Fuller never saved any of that stuff, and it's just disappeared.
Right.
I don't even know where you were.
Sure.
Yeah.
Yeah.
But I'll tell you a funny thing, Nigel, is Rory told some kids in San Antonio that he said he when he first locked up with me, he was waiting for me just to bear down, and then he said, my God, he said he was so light. He said, I always wish I had a chance to work with him because I don't think he would have hurt me. And I said, no.
Yeah, I mean, it definitely, you know, that the style that, you know, just was a real art form, you know, like making it look like you're killing each other, but not. I mean, and that's, you know, I'll be the first to say I was never the best at doing that. I mean, at the end of the day, the style that I developed, it wasn't that light. You know, it really wasn't.
Nigel, as you know, obviously you guys get the pleasure of going into post-production afterwards that can take out any, you know, flaws that there could be in a match and things like that. But has there been any time, you know, so far where you've seen something in the ring, and you being such a, you know, a great professional, a great representation of what that company was and is, and what they aspire to be, is there any time where you just chew the inside of your cheek or your lip, or you just want to, like, go in there and smack them? And is it hard to separate, you know, the announcing Nigel with the, you know, the active participant?
Difficult question. I mean, there's lots of thoughts that go through my head now when I'm sitting there and watching the show. You know, I never sort of go, well, oh, they shouldn't have done that, or, you know, I'd have done it that way or anything else like that. I'm far more in awe, I think, of the sacrifices and the dangers involved in professional wrestling now than I ever was when I was actually doing it. Because now I can sit back and I can see it, and especially when we're ringside and you can see the sweat fly and you just, I mean, sometimes I'm speechless because of the physicality of what's going on and knowing firsthand how real the violence is and how possibly dangerous it is. Sometimes that catches me off guard, and I try and put that over in the commentary as well and say, you know, and there was a couple of matches where that's been the case where I was almost, you know, dumbfounded just to watch those guys that are going out there and making those sacrifices because they genuinely believe, you know, in professional wrestling and certainly Ring of Honor's version thereof. And but aside from that, I mean, I don't watch the product and go, oh, you know, I want to be a wrestler again. I'm really happy with this, with my spot as announcer. I think it's a phenomenal opportunity for me. I think a lot of the guys want to obviously transition from taking bumps one day. And so it's huge for me. And I don't ever, I mean, every now and again, you know, when there's a fantastic match and the crowd's coming unglued, you go, ah, oh, you know, maybe I could, but then you just remember, you know, no, you had your time and you got to walk away sometimes, you know, you got to be able to. It's like, who was I telling someone? It was like, it's like a really hot chick, you know, and you pursue her and you pursue her and you pursue her, and eventually if she keeps spurning you, then you got to walk away and say it's your loss, so, and realize there's other chicks in the world. Like that for an analogy, right?
our friend BJ is making a comeback. He's working with Lethal here next Friday night in Cincinnati.
In Cincinnati, yeah. I've only heard nothing but great things about him. You know, people have said he's in great shape and he's come back better than ever, and he's, you know, looking fantastic and working fantastic, and good for him. And I couldn't be happier. You know, in a business where, God, how many people do you lose from various different things along the way before you're even 30 years old? And it's crazy to see BJ, who by his own admission had issues, you know, over the last, you know, decade of his life for various different things, to get back on track and really, you know, show that arguably it's never too late. So I wish I was there to see it. I wish I was there to shake his hand, say I was proud, and even, you know, call the match. Hopefully he'll get a shot on some TV shows or pay-per-views, and I'll be able to do that. So really good. Really happy for him.
Do some of the young guys in ROH now, do they come to you and ask you to critique their matches?
Yeah, very much so. A lot of the guys do. And not just the young guys either. You know, Davey Richards has come up to me on occasion, Eddie Edwards. There's such a great locker room there, all nonsense aside. It's everybody wants to learn and get better, and everybody's so humble. There's almost, I don't think there's anybody there with any kind of ego, you know. Everybody knows that they've got things that they can work on, things they can get better on, as everybody can. So, yeah, a lot of guys come up to me, not so much necessarily about matches or maybe spots that they might have an idea for matches, or maybe, promos beforehand, how that sort of stuff. And I'm loving that, because it's so much easier when you can step away to sort of see the match in a different way and see a promo in a different way. And I'll think about how it might be improved upon, or what might be a good direction to go in. And that's where I really, really hope that I can, transition in direction in the wrestling business.
Now, does anyone ever ask you to throw something in or to get something across into any of their matches or anything like that?
Not so much as asking me ideas and stuff. I know, Les, when you were commentating, did you like to have a sense of what was going to happen beforehand, or did you, like Jerry Lawler, likes to not know anything about what's going to happen and just call it as he sees it? For me, I kind of, it's like when I was a wrestler, I'd like to have some kind of idea, because I think I can build towards a story. But Les, how did you feel about that?
Yeah, I just, most of the time, during the major part of my career on the microphone was, we basically had some notes in the margins of our formats, about who we needed to get over, or some bullet point, an occasional bullet point. You like to know the finish so you can, so you can be sure to direct the viewer's eyes to what's needed to be seen. But, yeah, in a way, I think if you can build off of it, I think if you get a bit of surprise in your voice, it's, that's a good thing, too. Real quick, I'll tell you, someone had asked me, Brian Alvarez had asked about this. We were talking about Joe LaDuke, and I was telling him that I had Joe on a personality profile in Southeastern, and I forget who he was having a feud with, but he's, in that French-Canadian voice, I to show my sincerity, less that I intend to beat whoever it was, I will make my vow in blood. And he always carried that double-bladed axe, and he turned, this was at the end of our little five-minute segment, he turned his forearm up and sliced himself open with the friggin' axe. And I thought, what? I had no idea it was happening. And when we came off the segment, I said to Ron Fuller, I said, man, why the hell didn't you tell me he was going to do that? He said, listen, to get the expression on your face when you saw it was worth not telling you, because he said your mouth dropped open. You're like, what the hell?
That's great. Yeah. It's nice to have that genuine reaction to stuff. Absolutely. I've been surprised on a number of occasions actually watching Ring of Honor matches, which is a testament to the guys that are out there. They can still surprise me after all these years.
Then, Nigel, we don't obviously talk about Japanese wrestling too much on this show, but the longtime watcher of Japanese wrestling, and you were in the NOAH at a time where it was, actually chugging along very, very strongly. Unfortunately, we all know that Misawa has passed away, and that the company is not obviously quite the same. It's certainly a shell of what it used to be. But I want to ask you just about one guy there, Takashi Sugiura, who was always a big fan of. And he got a run with the GHC title, didn't lose it all that long ago, sometime last year, but was always a guy that seemed to be quite underrated. When you had a chance to go over there, and I always heard that he had worked with a lot of guys as far as, because of his amateur wrestling experience and his MMA knowledge, did you have a chance to cross paths with him too much, and what were your feelings on him? Because I always thought he was underrated, but there's very few guys to talk about. Bison used to, and there were a few others, but not too many people get a chance to go over to NOAH too often. So do you have any experiences with him?
I wrestled him in a few six-mans. I may have even have had a singles match with him. And he was always someone, maybe like Samoa Joe or someone like that you were always homicide. Kind of kind of afraid of, because just that legitimate side of them that you knew, if they wanted to, they could really kind of mess you up, you know. And that always kind of brought out the best in me, because you knew that, like, man, you had to be on your own game, because otherwise, you know, they weren't going to let you catch up. I think everybody had so much respect for him because of his background as well. He had great matches with a lot of people, without a doubt. It's difficult when you think about, you know, what it takes to be a great world champion. I mean, you can talk about that for years and years and years, you know. There have been great world champions, arguably weren't the best workers in the world, and vice versa, I think, you know. I mean, Pat O'Connor, I think, was a great world champion. Would you agree, Liz?
Yes, I would. And very underrated, yeah. Too, Nigel. Yeah, Pat was a hell of a worker. Yeah. And never, you know, when you talk about the great world champions, his name seldom comes up, and it should.
Yeah, very much so. And Segura was one of those guys that was just very, very talented, absolutely. And the funny, when you mention his name, and I always remember this when people talk about him, because I was very, very quite scared of him, and, you know, and he was such a hard worker, and he'd always be working out before the shows and doing his Hindu squats, as all those guys are in pro wrestling now, you know. There's no one who goes over there and just slacks around. But I don't know if you know, I'm quite a budding amateur magician, and we had a show in England, and Rusan, the owner over there for Pro Wrestling Noah, is a bit of an amateur magician as well. So I was, you know, showing my little card tricks to various different people. And Segura walked around the corner and saw that I was doing a magic trick. And I'm like, oh, God, you know, I was like a little bit, oh, God, don't mess this up. And so I did a card trick for him. And as I said, you know, he's very serious, very solemn, a lot of the time works hard, you know, really legitimate, tough guy. And when I did the magic trick, he popped like he was a 7-year-old girl. He was like, oh, wow. Like really huge for it. And I mean, I was like, amazing to see. Just, it made my week, made my year. It really did. So that was my recollections of him, and nothing but the utmost respect for him. And, so there you go.
And, you know, we're working over there, too, one last one on anything Japan. But obviously, knowing the situation it is, New Japan, a lot of people that read The Observer are kind of surprised to see the names Giant Bernard and Carl Anderson. You know, they don't realize Giant Bernard, Prince Albert, in a lot of cases, Hiroshi Tanahashi. Obviously, the business in Japan isn't great. But as far as a guy that would want to go over there, you know, all the challenges that it presents, and, you know, for different reasons, you know, Fergal Devitt is just a different wrestler, a completely different person than he was in Ireland, as opposed to what he is now coming out of that dojo. Best thing that you took, and I know it's probably difficult, but really, what's the best thing you took out of your Japanese experiences? Because it's not kicking guys really hard or anything like that. I don't think, at least. So what did you love the most?
I love the subtleties of what I learned over there. I mean, Japan itself is such an amazing country. A lot of times when you're a wrestler and you don't really get a chance to sort of visit a lot of the places where you're going. And with Japan, I was very blessed to be able to go. We were in Hiroshima a few times, and that was just an amazing city for so many reasons. And got to see so much of the culture and stuff like that. And that was something that I noticed. And Akiyama is a guy who, if we talk about underrated wrestlers, I mean, and you ask a lot of guys who went over there, and I think they'll all put him up there as one of the absolute best. And I don't know whether it's, you know, whether he took stuff from Harley Race, who, you know, had some time over there back in All Japan, or what it was, but his ability to just tell those subtle storylines, and that's what I got from, because, you know, when people talk about psychology, I think a lot of guys that, you know, work in the indies or anywhere really, even WWE over here, have a very sort of arguably narrow-minded sense of what psychology is. And psychology is really just telling a story that people can understand. It doesn't have to be the same story. It doesn't, you know, I mean, arguably that's the problem with so many of the shows you see, is you see the same psychology
psychology, the same story in every single match on the show, you know. Whereas in Japan, you'd see these subtle stories evolving, and because they're longer matches, 25, 30, 40 minutes, and you'd feel the way that the crowd was drawn into it. Much in the same way as when I was in England and watching Robbie Brookside, who had that same ability to draw people in, like he was telling a story, like literally, and then turn a page, and then this happens, and turn a page, and then this happens, and that was really what I took more than anything, at least in terms of the actual pro wrestling, that's what I took out of Japan, you know, and was forever blessed for it.
No, go ahead. Nigel and I have talked a few minutes before, I'm sure you've got a lot more questions.
I do. Well, one, back to the announcing thing for a minute, because and this is actually really for both of you guys, too. Booker T and a lot of guys who have come down to do commentary, you know, when the WWE sends them out there, one of the things that everyone seems to always have a problem is they're watching the match, not the monitor. And they have to be snapped back in their headset of, you know, and being fed something to say because you get caught up in watching the match. Was that difficult for you, Nigel, as far as, you know, that old story of you just get caught up watching the match at first? You got to remember, oh, yeah, I got to watch off the monitor because I'm supposed to be, you know, reporting on what people at home are seeing.
No, believe it or not, I have the other problem. I end up just watching the monitor, and sometimes I miss things that are actually happening in, obviously, where I'm sat close to the ring. I can see the guys, I can see the ring, I can see ringside, I can see the managers all in one shot. And I think that's sometimes very valuable because you can see things that aren't necessarily on the TV screen and either, you know, say something that hopefully the camera guys will pick up on or the producer will pick up to get a shot of that. Whereas a lot of times I will be just staring at the screen and watching that. And I always feel like I've got things to say, but it's just finding the right moment to say them. I mean, if somebody hits a big move, you don't want to say anything. You want to, you know, let that reaction reverberate through the TV screen. Someone gets a pinfall, same thing. You don't want to be talking about a different point. You want to, you know, one, two, and if they kick out, and then get to your point. So sometimes when I don't say a lot, at least when I was starting out, it was because I was trying to find the right time to say it as opposed to not really having anything to say.
I think that when I've, it's easier. The monitor is small, and of course the building is large, so it's easier to be drawn, your eyes drawn to the ring and away from the monitor. And I think at first it becomes, you know, you have to be more conscious of I need to pay attention to the monitor opposed to the ring, you know. And then after a while, it just becomes a natural thing. And there's been times I've done some shoots. Where they've been on there. Well, with Smokey, I had mentioned that Lance Russell and I, when we did the Bluegrass Brawl in Pikeville, Kentucky, we had no monitors, and they had a multi-tag match, and nobody had told us to finish. And so we didn't know what the hell we were supposed to call, and had to end up after the show. Everybody left the place. They set up a monitor out of the truck, and we went back and redubbed the last few minutes of the main event over because we had no idea where the hell we were supposed to be directing people's eyes because we didn't even know the finish. So, I think, you know, one of the things Nigel's talking about hitting the big moves and cover, you know, the pacing was a bit slower back in the 70s. And so we had a little more time to weave a story where, you know, he mentioned you see it's getting it in at the right place. And sometimes you've got something clever, quip, you know, clever to say, but the time is gone and there's no sense saying it, you know. And so you kind of catalog that for later at some point when you can fit it in.
Yeah, and it's tough as well, I think, certainly in Ring of Honor, when the guys are going out there, balls to the wall, and, you know, ding, ding, the bell rings, and within 2-3 minutes you've seen, you know, 20, 30 moves. And you don't want to ignore that because they're bumps, you know, and they're going out there and they're trying to get the crowd riled up. But if you're there sitting there talking about something else, which I know sometimes you have to do that, but at the same time, I always kind of hate it, especially when some of the lower matches on WWE, like Superstars or whatever else, where the guys would be going out there and trying to have a match. And I don't think the commentators even talked about the match the whole time, you know, it was just there as a backdrop for them talking about the angles. I mean, like, I get it. The angles draw money, and that's what you want to try and get over to the people, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. But that's the case. Why I'm wrestling in the background at all? I don't know. That's just my feeling.
And it's a damn shame, too, because it was like, you know, say you have a Madison Square Garden house show that used to be aired on, you know, on the MSG Network and other places, and they'd start off with Sam Houston against Jose Luis Estrada, and it's probably going to go about 10 minutes. And, you know, the announcers, obviously, they're talking about things building up also elsewhere on the card and other feuds and things like that. But I think, Les, in your era, you were very lucky in that nobody, well, I guess there may have been somebody screaming in your ear, but for the most part, you had a chance to again, like you said, weave a story and still give time and respect to the people that were in the ring wrestling.
Yeah,
and that's
absolutely.
Something today we don't get.
Yeah, well, you know, and here's the thing, too. It's kind of up to you. If, say, for example, you know a guy is doing a job in there, and maybe for some reason he's overselling it. So if you can, without making a fool of yourself and everybody else, because it is visual, it's not like it's radio, you try to make him better than he's making himself, if that's possible. You know, or if the mistake, if somebody's made a huge mistake, you try to, and it's on the spur of the moment. It's not like you have time. You don't have options A, B, and C. You know, it's like you're trying to cover his tracks, and you know, sometimes it's difficult. But that's part of your job too.
Right. Yeah. And Nigel, don't want to keep you on all night here, but I did not have the pleasure of being on the show the last time you were on. So a little birdie had told me to ask you about an experience you had eating chicken while driving that I had never had a chance to hear.
Chicken while driving? I think you must have got the wrong. Are we talking about the regurgitation story or not?
Well, I think it was, I believe you had gotten sick or something like that, and then much like a baby bird, ended up eating it twice, which...
this was back in the day. When I started out in Les will attest, you know, I came in, about $1.70, dripping wet, and, you know, didn't look much like a wrestler, by my own admission. And, you know, thanks to Les and Mike at the Power Station Gym in Middletown, they got me on a diet of just eating continuously. And it started out, I'd eat nothing but, like, cans of tuna, 8-10 cans of tuna a day, and potatoes. And after a while, you just couldn't stomach that. So I managed to find a cheap place to get chicken and managed to get chicken. And I got up to about, maybe 215, 220, something like that. And that's totally supplement free, no creatine. Not even any protein shakes, to be honest with you, just nothing but food every 3 hours, 6 a.m., 9 a.m., midday, the whole way through, 24/7. I didn't have a job. That was all I did. That was my job, you know, trying to be a professional wrestler and look like one as well. And I became so obsessed with it. But I just had to constantly add more and more protein. And, you know, Mike would say that I needed 2 grams per every pound of body weight. And so I'm about 210. I want to get up to about 225, 230, and then cut down to a lean 220. So, you know, I'm already stuffing myself, and I've got this huge gorilla belly. I'm talking around just from all the food that I'm eating. I've got to eat so much protein, I can't eat enough roughage and fibre to go with it. So it's all sticking in my colon. I've got a huge, massive belly. And I was just obsessed with it and just so worried that I wouldn't get my 2 grams per pound of body weight that one night after the show, I drove home and I did my last 2 chicken breasts of the day that I had to eat, and I'd eaten 1.5. And really, I was just on gag reflex. It was just so close. But I just only had like half a chicken breast, maybe even a third of one, very small part. And I just really just little by little, just nibbled and nibbled, and finally got the last chunk. And as soon as I put the last chunk in, and it went down, it hit my stomach, gag reflex was reached, and I just like threw up in my hands, which is bad enough in itself, but I was so obsessed and so worried that, oh my God, all these, you know, that's 35 grams of protein I'm now not going to have. I tried catching my vomit and force feeding myself, and that was when I realized that I had a big problem, and I couldn't be doing that anymore, so things have to change.
Let me say, I wouldn't advocate that, but I will say that the thing that, you know, I've had people, Mike, ask me, well, how did Nigel McGuinness get to be so good? I said, there's really not a special formula. It's just that he did what he was asked to do. He did it well, and he did it consistently. And as he just said, his job was to look like and become a professional wrestler, and he dedicated himself to it. And of all the hundreds of guys that have been through my places, this one, Mike, is one of the, that I'm the most proud to be a part of, because he's certainly carried himself with class and dignity, and you know, as one of the best of the young crop over the last number of years, without a doubt. You know, he's a credit to the business. He really is.
Well, thank you, Les. I appreciate it. That's very kind. Very kind of you to say.
Nigel, coming up here in a little over, 3 weeks or so, is going to be, the next ROHI pay-per-view. Can you talk about what's coming up here with Ring of Honor and have the last TV tapings in Baltimore one?
Yeah, it went really well. Every set of tapings, they just seem to get better and better and better, you know, not just from my input with it, but there's a lot of teething problems with Sinclair taking over, and finding out how to best shoot the show and light the show and edit the show and everything, you know, from square one right through to the little intricacies and the subtleties of it. And so it's really coming along great. And a lot of people are finding their stride now. Davey's had the belt for a while now, and he's really, you know, starting to get a lot of pace behind it, you know. And that's one of the things that Ring of Honor has always kind of been synonymous with, is that the titles mean something there. And with Jim and Hunter working behind the scenes, that's ever so much more prominent now, is that, you know, that's what's so important, that the people care about the characters, but also care about the matches and care about the belts. You know, they're not just a prop. It's very important. So, yeah, things are great, and I'm really excited about the future. We've got, like you said, the pay-per-view, the 10th anniversary show. That's going to be huge. A lot of matches to look on there, and then the TV taping afterwards, and then we've got the shows at the end of the March as well in Fort Lauderdale near Miami. It's great, you know. It's a great opportunity for everybody to step up and fill that void, without a doubt.
Nigel, I want to just thank you so very much for being on with us tonight. Will you do it again sometime?
Absolutely, yeah. I mean, I may need to do it relatively soon. I've got a few things in the works, without tipping my hat at them, that you know, I'd like to talk about at some point in the future, and so hopefully we can sort that out.
Don't tell Les. Les just gives information to everybody.
All right. Nigel, my friend, God bless you. It's always a pleasure. You know I'm in your corner. I love you, man, and the best to you, and take care of yourself, okay?
All right, God bless. I'll talk to you soon. I'll give you a call.
Right. And we'll be back on Ringside Wrap.
Hi, this is Eric Darnell.
This is David Reagan.
Jamie McMurray.
This is Carl Edwards here for RAD,
the entertainment industry's voice for road safety.
Want to make a difference? It's simple. Be responsible.
Plan ahead. Designate before you celebrate.
Friends don't let friends drive drunk.
A public service message brought to you by the U.S. Department of Transportation, RAD, the National Association of Broadcasters, and the Ad Council.
If you're a veteran of Iraq or Afghanistan, like me, coming home can be harder than expected. I felt a little out of place, but it turns out I wasn't alone.
At IAVA.org, there's a free online community of thousands of OIF and OEF vets who've got your back here, just like they did over there.
So now, I'm never alone. I can get the resources I need and talk to tons of people who understand where I'm coming from.
Whether it's navigating the GI Bill
or VA hospitals,
managing the transition home,
or meeting people you can share stories with,
you'll find it at IAVA.org.
Even if it's just everyday stuff.
Like getting tips on where to find a nice sweater for my dog.
Did he just say that?
What?
Okay, maybe not that, but everything else. No matter where you are, Iraq and Afghanistan Veterans of America is there for you. Join our community at IAVA.org.
We've got your back.
Brought to you by Iraq Afghanistan Veterans of America and the Ad Council.
Do you remember Tommy Rich? What about Ray Gunkel or Gordon Solie? Can't get those nasty Anderson brothers out of your head? Well, you can catch them again at GeorgiaWrestlingHistory.com. Who was on the first party you attended? Who was it under that mask? Remember the first Omni Spectacular or the big main events at the Bell Auditorium? That happened in Columbus on my birthday. Find out at GeorgiaWrestlingHistory.com. Whether you want to get back some of your past or maybe you just want to find pro wrestling in your area, check out GeorgiaWrestlingHistory.com.
What does Alison Krauss remember about music class when she was a kid?
My fondest memory of music class is kind of just an overall memory, not a specific instance, because music was something completely different than any other class in school. It was, I remember it as all being fun, and the reward wasn't, you know, a great test score, and it wasn't a higher grade. It was getting to be a part of an ensemble and singing something at the end where everybody knew their part. It was all fun and games to me, and you made friends. You know, I found that you made friends that lasted a really long time, at least the ones that, for me, that have lasted the longest are ones that I met in school chorus or in music classes and not who I sat next to in math.
A PSA brought to you by MENC, the National Association for Music Education, Gibson Guitar, Baldwin Piano, and this station. Music, part of a sound education.
This is Miss Rachel from The Empire, formerly known as Platinum Championship Wrestling. Every Friday night, The Empire presents the best in professional wrestling at the Academy Theater in Avondale State. We're also at the Masquerade every month or so. Check us out on Facebook. Just look for Platinum Championship Wrestling. And you'll get the latest details on all the hottest action from The Empire,
formerly known as Platinum Championship Wrestling.
We get it. That's every Friday night at the Academy Theater and at the Masquerade as well every month. We'll see you there.
This is President Barack Obama. In the story of America, the greatest chapters are moments of challenge, when we see people serving their country and one another. Volunteers who step forward into hospital corridors and church basements, along levees and fire lines. And the next chapter is yours to help write. Sign up to volunteer at usaservice.org. That's usaservice.org. Let's renew America together.
A message from Renew America Together, brought to you by the Ad Council.
All right, we're back here on Ringside Rap. Les Thatcher alongside Mike Sempervivi here with you. And, you know, that one could have played for a while. That just makes me wish I was back in New Orleans now. Les, how many times were you in the right place at the wrong time?
I'm more likely in the wrong place at the right time or something. You know, I was going to tell you, I was going to bring it up while Nigel was still with us, but when he came to me, he had never wrestled before in his life, but yet before he knew how to shoot a Ricky Steamboat arm drag. And I don't know if you know what I'm talking about, but Steamboat shoots one of the prettiest arm drags ever. And Nigel had taught himself on his bed at home in England after watching Steamer on the TV. And when I saw it, I thought, oh, my God, I mean, that's just amazing, you know. And this was when he was just getting his feet wet, you know, at our place and just learning. But anyway, a couple years later, we were doing the Mark Curtis, Brian Hildebrand fantasy camp the day before the Pilgrim show. And we were running a fantasy camp, Terry Taylor, Ricky Steamboat, Bill DeMont, myself, I forget who all was here. But anyway, some of my kids had come in to watch, and I told Nigel, show Steamboat how to shoot his arm drag, and he was real hesitant. But anyway, he finally got in the ring and threw a couple of them, and Ricky said, wow, he said, that's really great. And you could just see the smile on Nigel's face. I mean, he was, you know, just so proud that Steamboat thought it was, you know, it was a good job. But, you know, there's times like that are just so amazing that someone with star power themselves is so taken in a fan sense with someone else, you know, that they have watched. Now, Jericho was that way. You know, Jericho and Benoit were the main event in the first Pillman show. And on the second one, you know, Chris, well, of course, Benoit did come back, but Jericho was invited as well. But at the time, WCW was having one of those fan cruises, you know, that they did. And he called me and he said, wow, he said, you know, they've got me scheduled for this fan cruise, so I obviously can't make the trip. And he said, I'm really upset by that. As much as I'd like, you know, to contribute and be a part of the Pillman show, Ricky Steamboat's going to be there, and I'm a big Ricky Steamboat mark, and I want to meet him. And I got to thinking about that a couple years ago when they got the chance to work together, you know, at WrestleMania. I thought that was a big deal for Jericho. As big a star as he was, I'm sure he marked out for Steamer when they got a chance to work together.
But did Nigel come in? Did he have any rough edges, or was he always class?
What do you mean, did he have any rough edges? Everybody's
But just as far as being a human being, he seems like such a class act.
No, he was, you know, he was a good kid. He was, when he came, he had looked around. He was an exchange student. He was at Kent State University up in Northern Ohio. And he had looked around for a wrestling school. And what I guess drew him to me first wasn't the logistics, but the fact, and this is something that I always did, when if you sent for a brochure for our school, I would handwrite, you know, a response to your letter, you know. And that impressed him, that I had taken that personally, because I guess some of these schools he called, that, you know, the owners wouldn't talk to him, or they just didn't, you know. It was just they were cold or impersonal. So anyway, he called and asked to come down to see the school. And he and two of the kids from Kent State came down with him. And he was very, very much a gentleman, very polite, very, you know, and I'll never forget, I invited him to get in the ring just, you know, to like lock up collar and elbow, or, you know, a couple. I mean, we didn't go and trying to take bumps. But these kids that came with him were taking his picture in the ring, and I'll never forget that when we got in that ring, it was like it was a spiritual experience for him. You know, I mean, he was, you know, just excited, quivering, but I mean, you could just see the excitement of standing in that ring. He'd never been in a wrestling ring before in his life. And he told me, that he said, you know, I've got another year of university back home, and I'm coming back to train with you. And, of course, if I had a dollar for everybody that told me they were going to train with me, I'd be independently wealthy, right? So, I knew he was, you know, he was excited to be, you know, and was really enthused about wrestling. But here's a kid that's an Englishman. He's coming back to train me. Sure he is, you know. But sure enough, you know, he finished that year and got in touch with us and came back. And, you know, he worked harder. You know, some guys will say, well, gee, you know, you're a half hour from me, or you may not have to move to come train. And this guy, you realize he could only get a 6-month visa at a time. And so he would be here for 6 months. Then he had to go back home and wait to be able to get the next visa and come back. So it took him twice as long to finally get his first match as it would have normally. And, talk about the price he paid for it, Mike. It wasn't he liked to drive a half hour to get there or like Mick Foley sleep in his car. Hell, he had to cross the Atlantic Ocean several times. And I know at one point when he was back home, because we stayed in contact, he was working double shifts at a restaurant somewhere there near London. And he was sleeping on a mattress on his friend's kitchen floor to save money because, he said, well, the price of chicken over here is just, so high. And, of course, as he mentioned to you about the protein. Now, the guy he mentioned, Mike in Middletown, that's a friend of mine, Mike Ferguson, who's an ex-state highway patrolman but a competitive bodybuilder and owns a gym up the Power Station gym in Middletown. Mike was also the trainer and nutritionist for Rich Franklin. Yeah, so if you saw, in fact, Mike was on one of the lead-ins to one of Franklin's matches, and I don't remember which one, because I remember Rich saying, because I made the comparison, Rich said, this is hell, meaning the Power Station gym, and Mike's the devil. And but I've told a lot, I mentioned Roy Fox earlier. Roy trained up there, too. Mike was with his weight room the way I was with my ring. If you're not coming to bring your A game and work your ass off, then don't bother to come at all. And that was, that Mike and I bonded over that. He's just a great guy. His wife's a competitive bodybuilder as well, or was. I don't. But anyway, that was the Mike that Nigel was talking about. So, that's the crazy thing. It's just there's no secret ingredient except that Nigel had a passion and a love and a dedication for what he wanted to do, and he worked at it. It wasn't like he was an instant sensation either, Mike. That was, it wasn't. And that's the problem I see with this whole 8 weeks of training thing that some people do, or that they don't leave guys down in Tampa with the developmental long enough. You can't put a time limit and say, okay, if this guy's going to be good, he'll be good in 15 minutes or 15 days or 15 months. Because Nigel, I won't say he was a slow learner, but there were some that actually reached their peak in terms of their, their potential a lot quicker than he did. But then he's a hell of a lot better when he reached his potential than some of those guys could have ever been if they stayed in the business 30 years, So, I mean, that's the crazy thing. You have a driver's license. I have a driver's license. Did we both take the same exact amount of time to learn enough to be able to pass that test? Obviously not without even asking. But so you can't place a time limit on that. You with some of these kids, you have to have the patience. There are a lot of kids come in with a passion that just flame out and burn out immediately, quickly. And then there's other guys, I've had guys come in that, the first couple of months they go, oh my God, this guy's going to be a real keeper. But that was their peak, and they just did not progress past that. But he wasn't, he wasn't an overnight sensation or an instant sensation, but part of the reason he became what he was is his dedication and focus to do what he wanted to do.
Thinking about as you were saying that, he's very lucky. Obviously, you create your own luck too in a lot of ways, but he gets to leave. He's got a legacy, and I wonder if if he's got a chance to think about that or even bothers thinking about it. But I was just thinking about it. Obviously, you getting the ball rolling with him and the MTV thing, that is always going to be around. Or not, was it MTV or ABC? I can't remember what it was.
Well, it was both.
Documentary.
We were on both. Okay. ABC 2020 and the MTV special.
That's right. And he had that. He got a chance to work in Japan at a time where Noah was a big deal. And he basically got the last taste of an extension of All Japan
you know, the history that goes along with Baba's promotion, the Funks and everybody else that's gone through there. And, you know, he's the last of a lineage there. Was in Ring of Honor at the time where Bryan Danielson, Samoa Joe, himself, I mean, a lot of guys were peaking. And, you know, there's probably going to be people out there that look at him, well, you know, the visa issues he had and whatever issues he had with, you know, not being able to get into WWE and lots of stuff like that. But, you know, he's been able to be a guy that's come around recently, you know, post even Jericho and guys like that. But, I mean, the past couple of years who really, because of his work, he's really been able to carve out, he's got a very special place. And, you know, you getting the ball rolling on that, I mean, for as much as, you know, the Ring of Honor fan might, you know, take the dig at you and things like that, and obviously, you know, making light on it here, but they love Nigel, and it's just, you know, it's got to make you laugh, and it's got to make him laugh, too, where it's just, you know, you getting that ball rolling, you know, people may not like you or what you say or how you say it, but it was right because they fall, you know, and looking at Nigel's legacy, I mean, they're going to be following him, and he's going to be a guy to shoot for, because so much of his story is so visible, and he's such a good guy at telling it, too, where he's a very lucky guy, and you got a chance to get that ball rolling, and that effect is going to be felt for a long time. And the fact that he's commentating, and is one of those guys who's lucky enough to have a spot, if this takes off with Sinclair and the Ring of Honor, that can continue on for a lot longer.
And when I say, you mentioned Joe and Bryan Danielson and Punk and so forth, that is the ingredient for whatever reason. And there's some good kids in Ring of Honor right now, but there's nobody that has that it factor that Joe had, that Punk had, that Nigel had, that Dragon had. There's just not. I mean, that's not to be demeaning. It's just, you know, it's to say that the current Patriots, you know, lost the Super Bowl, but that doesn't mean that they were obviously great enough to get there, you know, but they weren't the same Patriots that won the Super Bowl in, what, 5 years ago or whenever it was, which doesn't mean they were bad. It's just that they weren't at that same level as the champion Patriots. And I think there is, for whatever reason, you know, that spark is not in Ring of Honor now that, you know, that was there when those guys were champion. And I think had Jamie Noble have stayed, you know, and not gone back to WWE, he would have been the same type of champ, because Jamie is just a tremendous performer. He was a guy that I loved to work with the year that he spent with me. You know, he was just so focused and dedicated and such a tremendous performer. I'll tell you a funny story there. He and Benoit were in town with a day off. And, of course, I don't know that there was anybody else from the company in town, so they could have possibly just laid, you know, in their rooms and watched television and ate French fries and, you know, drank beer for all that matter. They went over to HWA, excuse me, and used the one ring. And while the kids that were in class were in the, with it, there were two rings set up, and they were using the one, and they just working out together for a period of time, when they left that ring, the canvas was soaked with sweat. Now, that's how dedicated. Jamie always reminded me a little bit of a smaller version of Benoit anyway. But Jamie, like I say, if he'd have stayed in Ring of Honor for a length of time, he would have been in that same category we're talking about with Joe and Punk and Dragon and Nigel.
Yeah, for those who didn't get a chance to see that. At that time, he was going by, you know, I'm not sure if his real name or not, I think it is James Gibson, right?
Yeah.
And he was using that name, so if anybody ever looks for, you know, his time there, that's the name he was using, obviously, with Jamie Noble being owned by WWE and the name to use in WCW. That was awesome. And I liked him. He kind of stood out to me in WCW, and then, you know, obviously WWF bought him out. And, you know, he went over, was one of those guys that went over to you, and obviously you didn't get a chance to see him there. But you could see it in WWE a little bit, but you could really see in Ring of Honor. I had no idea
just because you never got a chance to really see him do it, I had no idea how good he was until seeing him in Ring of Honor and how strong that title run was.
He was so intense, and I mean, the you know, you could just feel it, the intensity coming off, radiating off of him. And talking about being the right, you mentioned that, you were joking about being the right place, the right time, and so forth. When that whole redneck messiah thing, I coined that just more or less as a joke. But he was trying to find a level as a promo. And we called it Bumpless Tuesdays, and we did all sorts of different promo exercises and stuff. But this was when Brian Adams was there with me and was helping out. And so Jamie was struggling with trying to be a Rhodes Scholar or whatever. And we said, just be yourself, you know, talk about, you know. And so he just, you know, he let that Southern accent takes place. And my daddy, you know, if my daddy found out I was doing, you know, this and that, and we just both lit up over, Brian and I both lit up over that and said, yes, you know, and that's what, you know, that's what we pushed for him to develop. And then more as a joke, I said, you're the redneck messiah, you know, so he picked up on that. And that's, you know, and we started pushing. I was telling somebody, gosh, I don't know who was it, maybe it was Brian on the show the other day about the match that he and Val Venus had, and we were talking about the size difference, you know.
Yeah.
But they had a hell of a match where the fans, you know, you could see the fans were comparing sizes before the bell rang. When the bell rang at the end of the match, Val had got his hand raised, but they weren't comparing sizes then because these guys told that great story, you know. But it wasn't that, you know, Jamie went out there to become the Giant Killer. I mean, it was a good wrestling match as well. And I had a hell of a crew of guys, and I mean, I really did. And, well, you know, when Nigel, before the guys came in on the developmental contracts, we had a hell of a crew here anyway. I had a lot of good guys that, I mentioned BJ Whitmer. To Nigel, he was there, started when Nigel did. My Matt Stryker was there. A guy by the name of Ray Steele, Cody Hawk. We had a guy called McMurphy, the taxi driver. Taxi was his nickname. He was a taxi, you know, supposedly a taxi driver. We had a hell of a crew of guys. We really
did. You didn't mention Pepper
Shark
Park,
Boy.
Did you?
Huh?
You didn't mention Pepper.
Yeah, Pepper Parks. Yeah. Chet the Jet.
Chet Jablonski, was that his name?
Chet Jablonski. And Dean Jablonski, who was Dean Visk, who was also in developmental. All those guys were here with me. And Chet and Pepper came right out of high school in Buffalo together at age 18. They graduated from high school and moved down here to start training. Dean had came out of Pittsburgh. He'd already been working a little while. Came down here to actually learn to work. And Shark Boy was here. He started here with me. And we had a hell of a crew of guys. We really did. Rory Fox, who was the centerpiece of the MTV special. So we had a hell of a crew of guys on top of getting the guys in, you know, out of WCW, the cruiserweights out of WCW, Shannon and Jamie and guys like that. And
Elix Skipper there too?
Yeah, Elix was here. Yeah, absolutely. He was a hell of a hand, too. Good kid, too. Very good kid. And Kaz Hayashi.
Oh, I loved. See, I loved Hayashi because I got a chance to see him, you know, basically from the start of his career. I just got lucky with tapes and things like that. And I really, talk about an underutilized guy.
Yeah, I've still got a bottle of sake that he gave me when he went back home to Japan. They did a feature on us, one of the Japanese magazines. I've got a copy of that somewhere when he was here with us. They came over and did a story and stuff. A real class act, that young man. He was quite a gentleman. And so, but anyway, yeah, we had a hell of a crew. I would venture to say one of the best beneath the actual WWF or WWE roster. At that time, we had as good a crew as anybody in the country. Plus, you know, at one point, you know, I had four or five guys from the main roster down here as well, Val and D'Lo, and at different times, Raven, Incredible, Dreamer, Brian Adams, Haku. Lord, I mean, we had a hell of a crew. We really did.
Now, I know who would disagree with you on that, and of course that would be Dandy Davis and Jim Cornette, because at that time too, OVW, the names in OVW, and of course, you know, Richard's going to kill me if I don't go to break here, so I know I got to go to break, and we're going to be back after that with a little bit of UFC talk and a little bit of old school book talk as well, but we're going to do that right when we get back.
Georgia wrestling fans, you're going to want to make your plans to be at Johnny G's the first, third, and fifth Sunday of every month, 2 p.m. bell time, for Rampage Pro Wrestling television taping. And fans, if you're in Middle Georgia, make sure that you watch Rampage Pro Wrestling on Fox 24, Saturday 9 a.m. on the My 41.2, Saturday at 10 p.m. Cox Communications Cable, Thursday 8, Saturday at noon, and of course, Rampage Rewind, the one-half-hour show on Cox Communications throughout the schedule. Fans, be there.
Do you remember Tommy Rich? What about Ray Gunkel or Gordon Soley? Can't get those nasty Anderson brothers out of your head? Well, you can catch them again at GeorgiaWrestlingHistory.com. Who was on the first card you attended? Who was it under that mask? Remember the first Omni Spectacular or the big main events at the Bell Auditorium? What happened in Columbus on my birthday? Find out at GeorgiaWrestlingHistory.com. Whether you want to get back some of your past, or maybe you just want to find pro wrestling in your area, check out GeorgiaWrestlingHistory.com.
This is Miss Rachel from The Empire, formerly known as Platinum Champions of Wrestling. Every Friday night, The Empire presents the best in professional wrestling
at the Academy Theater in Avondale State.
We're also at the Masquerade every month or so.
Check us out on Facebook. Just look for Platinum Champions of Wrestling.
And you'll get the latest details on all the hottest action from The Empire,
formerly known as Platinum Champions of Wrestling.
We get it. That's every Friday night at the Academy Theater and at the Masquerade as well every month. We'll see you there.
Back here on Ringside Wrap, Les Thatcher joining me, Mike Sempervivi tonight.
You know what, Mike Sempervivi, with the music tonight, all we need is a disco ball and some flashing lights, man.
I was just thinking, you know, only a couple of years ago I went and saw Parliament Funkadelic, and I've seen them a few times just because they happen to be around, and I will say this, for $25, you get $25 worth, and it just amazes me that George Clinton is still alive. And no offense
hey,
to George Clinton, but
do you know his lead guitar player, Bootsy Collins?
Oh yeah, oh yeah.
He doesn't live 20 minutes from where I'm sitting.
Really?
Bootsy's a Cincinnati boy. Absolutely. He played guitar with James Brown before he was with Funkadelic.
Oh yeah, he's got great stories on James Brown. some of his stories he's told on how James would cut them in on the money, and as far as, you know,
yeah.
Some of those stories are fantastic.
Yeah, Bootsy's a native of Cincy. In fact, he and Jeff Ruby, who owns several restaurants, high-dollar restaurants in the area, along with people like Chris Collingsworth and Boomer Esiason and so on, are investors in some of those. They opened a club downtown. It's closed for some reason, but Bootsy and Jeff Ruby had a club downtown. But, yeah, Bootsy's wife was an aerobics instructor at one of the Gold's Gyms here in town, too, at one time.
We've got to find a way to get Bootsy on the show. Oh, man. Now, somebody who probably won't be on the show is Nick Diaz, who, and I'll go through this. I'm sure by now anybody that would want to know knows that UFC 143 took place this past Saturday night at the Mandalay Bay in Vegas. And, you know, for anything anybody can say about this not drawing well, it's not going to draw great. And, you know, people point to problems in the UFC. Still probably going to do around 400,000 buys. So, you know, no real crying should be done on the UFC's behalf. But Nick Diaz, Carlos Condit, this was the match that was supposed to be GSP against either one of these guys over the past couple of months. And GSP ends up being the one getting hurt, so they need to have an interim welterweight title match. And they do. And Nick Diaz loses to Carlos Condit in a razor-thin decision. Depending on how you look at it, a lot of complaints coming out of this, a lot of people thinking Nick Diaz should have won. I don't agree. I thought Condit won the fight. It was a very close fight. I could see how people might have given Diaz the win, but I'm not in that camp of people who are that outraged. And today has been, in the last several days, there's been a lot of talking back and forth over whether there would be a rematch or not, because GSP is probably not going to be ready to fight until December to quote-unquote unify the titles. So there was talk of them doing a rematch. As of now, 9:45 p.m. On Wednesday, it doesn't look like it's going to take place. And if I'm Condit, I kind of don't blame them there. You know, you have a title fight set up. People have lost title fights by taking other fights and losing. So I do understand his point there. As far as a fighting point of view, I think he could come out of another fight with someone, no matter who it is, if it's Diaz or somebody else, a lot better than he came out of this one. Fought a defensive fight, fought a smart fight, but didn't fight all that exciting of a bout. And when it comes to GSP, sometimes you need to bring some excitement and some action to the fight, because GSP has been such a dominant champion and has been, basically a wrestler, which is that doesn't make it super fun for a lot of fans out there to watch. It's not an aesthetically pleasing style when you're just being a defensive wrestler the whole time. You know, sometimes the opponent needs to bring something to the table, and Condit really didn't come out of this with that. But Les, I don't know if you heard anything about it at all at the gym or anything like that, as far as how anybody may have thought about it.
Well, you know, I listened to Dave and Brian, and then, you know, I heard a couple other. But like you said, everyone seemed that Condit had, you know, won anyway. It was, you know, and that, you know, even though some people thought it was controversial, he was the winner. You know what? I know, and I've heard Dave and Brian discuss, you know, the whole Fox thing, and I'm guilty of something they had mentioned. Is Saturday night, I am so accustomed, or unaccustomed, I guess I should say, of UFC not being on Fox, that the damn free part of that show was almost over before I realized I could watch it. And, yeah, I mean, you know, I was sitting here watching some, I had some stuff on the, you know, DVR'd some stuff, and I'm thinking, Jesus Christ, you know, UFC's on Fox. And I looked at the clock, I thought, hell, it's all, you know, I think I caught the last half hour. But I hope their ratings work well there.
I think they made a good tactical move. You know, one of the problems they had was when the thing started, it was 5 o'clock on the West Coast. People got things to do on a Saturday in the West Coast, especially in LA, which is a good market for them. So they were hampered there because there was no split feed. Fox treats it like any other live sporting event that they have. It's going to be, hey, it's live. You know, watch, hear about it later on SportsCenter, but we're airing the thing live across the country. And it seemed to hurt their ratings a little bit, but I think they made a smart tactical move because they're going to hold the next UFC on Fox show in the Staples Center in L.A. So I think that's a good way to attract and fire up Vegas and L.A. and get an event going on during the day and making, you know, them tune in, because the rest of the country is going to have no problem, and the ratings were good for this. So I think that was a smart move right there.
Yeah, but, you know, the change of venue or a change of networks and stuff, from past experiences in the wrestling business, I find that it's not uncommon. As much as you may advertise it or plug it, there are people that are not going to catch on right away, you know, for some reason or another. I've seen that with venues, you know, where we would work a smaller venue on a weekly basis in a particular town and then go to the larger Coliseum for, you know, a super show or whatever you want to call it. And in the smaller, you know, in the weekly venue, you're advertising, you know, don't forget next week we're at such and such, 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 such. And then 2 weeks later you go back to your weekly, the smaller venue, and somebody says, where were you guys at last week? You know, we came to the matches, you weren't here. Thought, my God, we plugged it on television, and the ring announcers, you know, hitting it hard too. It's just, it's, you know, for some reason it doesn't sink in right away. So I hope they finally, you know, they built a good clientele on Fox, because I think Fox has done a really good job of, you know, of putting the product over, honestly. Don't you?
Oh, God, absolutely. And I think there's, you know, that people live in a, sometimes a small prism, and they live in a bubble, even though they call other people out for living in bubbles. You know, this Fox thing is, you got to think about the, when it comes to the UFC, you've got to think about them 10 years down the line and what they're trying to build. And yes, I know there's people that complain about oversaturation, but with that said, you know, you don't watch every single minor league baseball game out there in all these different leagues and in the, you know, Japanese leagues, and you don't watch everything. You know, you watch the ones that are supposed to be promoted on pay-per-views and on network TV, but they're really, I think, doing a good job laying a root structure to just make sure that this sport is sport. And it stays in the, you know, in the lexicon. I mean, I know people bash boxing, but boxing still looked at as a mainstream sport. And maybe a rough one right now, but, you know, baseball, football, hockey, you know, there's states, New York State, the UFC is not legal in, you know, again, until all those barriers are down, and, you know, Fox is in this thing for the long haul, and I mean, putting Kurt Menefee up there, letting them use the music. I mean, they could have treated this thing as an entire separate entity if it failed or if they made it look bad, and they didn't. They went in feet first like they did for the NHL and NASCAR and the NFL. And I think they've done a damn good job, a really good job.
Yeah, I think
they haven't touched Rogan. They haven't touched Rogan and Goldberg. They let them be themselves, and this is what HBO can get through their heads. They've let the UFC be the UFC because they know what they're doing, and Fox has added their touches.
Yeah, I think Kurt Menefield and well, you know, Randy and Jones weren't that comfortable. But, of course, you know, we were talking to Nigel or like Terry Taylor, you know, it's not something you just don't. I mean, there might be the odd person that's going to walk in there and just, you know, be glib and sharp. But, you know, the natural inclination is when you first do that is to be a bit uncomfortable and is in an unfamiliar environment, you know. So it's going to take a while to build, you know, to build a broadcast team, you know, in that sense. I mean, I wouldn't mess with, you know, Goldberg, or, you know, or the Rogan, but, you know, for the other guys, it's going to take a while. And you know, the other thing, like on that first time out, where they could have run some highlights of, you know, the knockout was so quick that they could have run some highlights of something else, and they didn't, and they should have, I think. But then,
oh, absolutely,
you learn from little mistakes like that. But I'm looking forward to it. I really am.
Yeah, and, you know, it wasn't so awful of a show or anything like that where I don't think people will watch the next time. And, again, they're lucky enough to have a good Lazarus effect of, you know, it takes one knockout to open the next show or one great submission or something like that to have people calling their friends going, you know, I know you didn't like this last time. You have got to see this.
Yeah.
I think, you know, and, again, that's the greatness of live sports, too, and what sucks you in. And, again, there's people
sure
that are not gonna like this sport, and, you know, no matter what. But you know, as far as it becoming a Saturday night thing, hey, you know,
yeah,
I'm not a big baseball fan.
You know, Mike, that's something what you just said too about, you know, telling, hey, you missed this or you shouldn't have. That's what, you know, that's something I tell these independent promoters. You have to give instead of your matches being mediocre or just a bad copy of what you see on television, you're in a position, you don't have that kind of media machine or the money to have that kind of media machine. So the few people that show up at your weekly or monthly show or whatever it is, you've got to send them home to talk to people and say, hey, you should have gone to this little wrestling match I went to the other night. It was really good or entertaining. You need to go back with me the next time, so you know, I think you'll enjoy it. That's where so many of these small promotions are missing the boat. You know, they're more intent on copying what they see on television, and that is the wrong approach. And quite, you know, that was the thing. You know, here again, we go back to the guys that I've trained, and Nigel and Carl Anderson started with us, as you know, and you know, but we were intent on wrestling. You know, I didn't necessarily want to sell what was on television. We needed to sell, you know, wrestling. And I wanted my guys to look like wrestlers because it wasn't my intent was never, before I ever got a deal with WCW or WWF, my intent wasn't to develop guys to stay with me. The promoting wrestling and shows was something I had to do to give the kids that I was training an outlet, because all I wanted to do was train guys. I didn't want to be a promoter. And so it was my thought was, with every guy that ever came through my place, was to prepare them to move up to Japan or WWF or ECW or, you know, or WCW at the time, because we had more outlets, obviously. And too often now it's just that, you know, that's not the mindset. It's to just, you know, emulate what you see on television, which sometimes is detrimental to what you're trying to do. But I you know, I think with what you said, you know, about UFC, is that's the deal. Is they have a chance to hit a whole new audience, and it's got to be, you know, that give that the audience that does catch it something to say to the neighbor or something. Hey, you know, if you're a boxing fan, you might want to see this, or, you know, hey, your kid wrestled in high school, you might want to check this out, or this was entertaining, you know. I mean, but that word of mouth can be far more effective and also far more detrimental than $1 million advertising budget at times.
Well, I'd love to have actually somebody on with us to talk amateur wrestling and what MMA could do for amateur wrestling, what amateur wrestling can really get out of MMA. And then again, we're up here at the end, and we didn't get a chance to do old school this week. I wanted to talk a little bit about Tim Hornbaker's book, about the National Wrestling Alliance, the untold story of the monopoly that strangled pro wrestling. He's got a new book coming out soon, Legends of Pro Wrestling, where he goes back about 150 years. And, you know, if it's anything like his NWA book, it's going to be a must read and filled with, you know, an incredible amount of unseen, you know, news reports and correspondence between promoters and things like that. I mean, he's just
right.
Done a great job. And his website, I should mention that, one, you can buy, number one, you can buy the NWA book. Go to ringsiderap.com and georgiawrestlinghistory.com or ringsiderap.com to see how you can order that, because it's I know Rich loves the book. I've read it as well, and it's a fantastic book. You can buy that. But Tim's new project.
Talking about the history of the NWA?
Oh, yeah.
Yeah, I've got that, yeah, too. That, yes, that is
good.
A great book. Yeah.
Love it. Tim's got the Legacy of Wrestling .com website up right now, where, I mean, really a lot of really interesting things in there. I was actually looking at Willie Gilsenberg's biography. I mean, he's just got an incredible amount of stuff that he's doing to put up there, and doing what hopefully we try to do every week, which is keep pro wrestling alive and why it actually matters. So we'll be talking about that next week, as well as talking to Mac McMurray, who's going to talk a lot about the places that he worked in Knoxville and everything like that. And I also wanted to mention that Thursday night, Pete's Day Pandemonium with Mike Norris, Jerry Oates, and Bobby Simmons is going to have Terry Lawler on, who's the winner of the 2012 Ted Allen Legends Award for the Georgia Wrestling History Awards. And he's promoting this weekend's second annual Ted Allen Memorial Show, and got a whole lot of stuff going on there, and I'm running out of time here. So, Les, any plugs for you?
Yeah, well, of course, you know, Mike Johnson and I recorded today. That's up on the Insider site, and Saturday, Vic Socia and Will Strauss and I will be doing Wrestling Weekly for the Figure Four Observer site. I'm going to be in Mobile the 2nd and 3rd of March for the Gulf Coast reunion. I'll be in Vegas for CAC. That is the 16th, 17th, and 18th of April. And I found out this week that I will be going to the NWA Legends Fan Fest in Charlotte. That is August 2nd through the 5th. And in talking to Greg Price, there's a couple things that I can't – I'll let him, announce, but some events going on within the Fan Fest that have not been done in the past. So I think it'll be of interest, especially to some of the independent wrestlers and also some of the fans. So I'm hooking up with some things this year. I'm happy to be active again.
I'll be darned. He's actually going to give you a check that doesn't bounce. That's what he's going to stand up there and do. He's actually going to buy you dinner or something like that for once.
Well, I'll go for it, Mike. I'm always in for a free meal, man. I'm an ex-professional wrestler, and we're always up for free meals. Take my word.
And Adam Silvers and I will be doing a new Big Audio Nightmare very soon. Brian Alvarez will be back, and I will be back. Wrestling Observer Live this coming Sunday, 6 to 8. And I hope when you get a chance to do that show with Brian and Lance Storm that you chastise him and remind him, no matter what Dave said, Ricky Steamboat drew more money with other guys not named Ric Flair, or at least drew money with other guys not named Ric Flair. The Road to Greensboro, Paul Jones, that guy Brian hates, but it's enough ranting by me. And Les, thank you. Nigel,
thank you
very
always
much.
A pleasure.
And we're going to talk to everybody again next week.
We thank you for listening to this broadcast, a production brought to you by GeorgiaWrestlingHistory.com and the GWH Radio Network. Stay tuned to GWH for nostalgia, upcoming events, and more. As always, GeorgiaWrestlingHistory.com thanks you for your continued support.